Welcome to Profit Boss Radio, where successful women have paved the road to their own financial freedom. Each week, your host, Hillary Hendershot, financial coach, money mindset expert, and experienced wealth manager, will help you discover the keys to the wealth and peace of mind you want and deserve in her no-nonsense and authentic style. Starting right now.
Welcome to episode 61 of Profit Boss Radio. This morning, I actually want to bring you in a little bit on how I produce the show and give you some insight about some of the things I've been thinking about that I think are pretty exciting. So this obviously isn't a live show. I pre-record everything you hear and then we produce it and then it gets aired. And a lot of the topics I talk about are timeless, so unaffected by current events, but many of you have been asking for comment on current news and I can do that. I love to do that. And I think a fun way to work that in is I'll just pick some articles or stories to talk about in the intro. So I can be really current by recording the show's introductions very close to the air date of the show. It's March now. So how's it going? Getting ready for tax time. If you're in the US, are you done? Taxes are due. Actually, I think tax day, April 15th is a Saturday this year. So technically tax day is April 17th. Are you totally procrastinating? My husband and I had an appointment with our tax guy already, but we have so many business entities between us. And since you know from the anniversary show where I interviewed him about being a hedge fund manager, I interviewed my husband, not my tax guy. We get end of year tax reporting on our investments. Like you probably get a 1099 from your custodian if you have taxable investments. We get what's called a K-1. And basically, if you have a K-1, you file your return on extension. So we don't actually file our taxes in April. We file them by October 15th every year. And that's just the way that goes. So I'm on time for my taxes, but they're not done and they won't be done on April 15th. But most of you have to file your taxes by April 15th. So let's do a little check-in about that. If you have IRA or Roth contributions that you want to count for 2016 because you want to max out that allowance, you can still deposit those funds into your accounts as long as you do it before you file your taxes. So you can go drive by Schwab with a check on your way to the post office and you're still all good. I hope you're taking steps to maximize your deductible contributions to retirement accounts because when you start taking your money seriously, that's the first thing you want to focus on. All right, let's talk about current news. I have here an article just published this month by my pal, William Chettle, one of the smartest guys I know. I'm going to summarize this article for you because I know William won't mind if I tell you his article in my words. The basic gist of the article is really a key principle of successful investing and something I want you to be able to internalize over time. And that is that risk is not bad. Risk is actually a good thing. I have the article here. It is called Why Uncertainty Might Just Be an Investor's Best Friend. Okay, so he says, look, stock markets are at all-time highs and there's a lot of turmoil in Washington and you might feel pretty unsure of what to do next. I'm starting to hear this from people. Well, do you think we might be in a bubble? Do you think the bottom is going to fall out of the market soon? And, you know, it would be cool if we had a sure thing. And that would make us probably feel more comfortable investing. But one of the things that we don't realize is that the unpredictability of markets is actually a good thing. In fact, direct quote from William's article, the risks created by uncertainty can also mean potential rewards. Just as great uncertainty usually entails minimum rewards. For example, and he uses US Treasury bills as an example, those are pretty much a sure thing. They're backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. The United States Treasury, I think it says, is the specific language, but basically the government. Those debts are going to get paid. And those are returning about 3% right now. And 3% is actually just fractions of a percent above where inflation it probably is. So the net real return from holding a very secure investment right now is zero. And one of the paradoxes of investing is that if any investment offers a guaranteed return, so many people would want to own it. And you know what happens when demand increases, that they would be willing to take a slightly lower return and then a slightly lower return and then a slightly lower return. And pretty soon the return on that guaranteed investment would approach that of T-bills. Still, this doesn't stop media pundits from claiming they have insight and can pierce the veil of uncertainty and provide us with clarity. Let me give you an example of just some of the headlines that are popular now. For example, how a Trump presidency will affect 15 industries, or how to invest under a Trump presidency, or seven top stocks to buy with Trump as president. And these articles are going to get tens of thousands of clicks because everyone wants to know and everyone thinks that the investing prescription is specific to the time period or current events. And many of these headlines appear in the same publications that also predicted economic catastrophe if Trump were elected. And as you know, the markets have essentially gone up since Trump became president. And think back to when President Obama was sworn into office in 2009, the Great Recession was getting worse, and the S&P 500 index was at just 805 points. You might have thought that that was a really bad time to invest. So where are we now? 8 years later, the S&P 500 was at 2,274 points and had a cumulative 235% or 16.4% annual return. But what if you had tried to invest in specific sectors? For example, Obama's speeches and policy proposals said that defense spending would not be a priority. So you might think that defense stocks would go down. Firearms might be restricted, so those should go down too. There'd be increased spending on renewable energy, so solar should go up, and that banks and financial firms were going to be subject to stronger regulations, so those should go down. What if you had invested based on those fairly reasonable assumptions? Well, the solar industry didn't actually see the gains many would have expected. In fact, the MAC Global Solar Energy Index saw a 79% decline during Obama's two terms. Meanwhile, the defense industry, as measured by the S&P's Aerospace and Defense Select Industry Index, had a healthy cumulative return of 274% during the next 8 years, which beat the S&P 500 index. Even the S&P 500 Financials Index returned a relatively robust cumulative 165.32%. As for firearms, Smith & Wesson and Sturm Ruger, the only two publicly traded firearm stocks, grew 1,050% and 832% respectively during Obama's two terms. So what's an investor to do? Ignore the pundits, diversify broadly and globally, and embrace uncertainty and the potential it may offer to reward you over the long term for the risk it entails. There you go, Profit Boss. Risk is actually a good thing. So just as a metaphor, imagine if you're related to leaving your house and getting in the car in the morning as like that's a really risky activity. Most of you don't think that, but the data actually says maybe you should. If you're below the age of about 60, I think the most likely place you're going to die is in the car. I mean, a lot of people die in car accidents, but do you feel like you are taking your life in your hands every time you get behind the wheel? Probably not. And yet, if you ask most women why they're not invested in the stock market, the answer is almost always risk. I don't want to take the risk. So there's no doubt if you never left your house that you'd be taking less risk than you do if you get in your car and drive on the freeway. But what kind of life would that be? What would you tell your boss? Sorry, I can't make it to the meeting today. Freeway driving is just too risky. Can't do it. You wouldn't have a job for very long, and then you'd have no money, and pretty quickly you can see where things are headed there. That's not a good outcome, and that's all because you didn't want to take risk. So when you think about investing, if you tell yourself it's too risky, just ask yourself how much risk you took when you left the house this morning. The next article I have on deck was sent to me by a listener, and it's titled Buffett's Bet with Hedge Funds. It's a pretty good story. Basically, in 2008, Warren Buffett challenged the hedge fund industry to a bet. Buffett considers hedge funds to be a bad investment because their fees are so high. And again, if you listen to episode 55, you know that they are high. But Buffett says to them basically that he thinks people would be better off just investing in the S&P 500 index fund than investing in hedge funds. And a firm called Protégé Partners took him up on it. They placed a $1 million bet. Protégé got to hand pick a portfolio of hedge funds. What they picked were called funds of funds, so lots of underlying hedge funds. And the hedge funds charge fees, and then the fund of fund funds, charges fees, and the two parties pitted their horses against each other in a 10-year race. For a while after the financial crisis in 2008, it looked like the hedge funds might win. But at this point, it's looking like Buffett is a sure winner. The S&P 500 index is up 85.4% since the start, while Protégé's basket of funds is only up 22.0%. Amazing, huh? Buffett said in his shareholder letter that he believes the hedge fund managers involved in the bet were honest and intelligent people, but that their investors are dismal, and they are dismal. And this is a funny quote from Buffett. He says that given the 2 and 20 fee structure most hedge fund managers charge, I can't seem to actually say hedge fund today, and the returns that they're earning, that most of these guys are showered with compensation despite only providing esoteric gibberish in return. I thought that was pretty funny. And you might wonder, Hillary, why are you saying this to us given you're married to a hedge fund manager? Well, look, first of all, this podcast is about what's best for you, and you can count on me to give that to you. Second, let me compare the hedge fund industry to, say, the NFL. You have rank and file players, and then you have Tony Romo. And even I know who Tony Romo is. Most NFL players make $250,000 a year, and then Tony Romo is so good, he makes $12 million. He's like in the stratosphere compared to most of them. And there are hedge fund managers who are the Tony Romos of their game, and the object is to be Tony Romo. And that's all I have to say about that, because that's all that's relevant to the show. All right, let's get to today's interview, which is an everyday heroine named Katie. If you're new to the show, Everyday Heroine is a series that I do on the show when I find women who have done something really impressive in their financial lives. These aren't stars or experts or coaches or people who speak on large stages. They're ordinary people that you and I can learn from. And whether their story involves surviving financial abuse or recovering from disaster, or in Katie's case, just keeping her eye on the prize, regardless of the world not easily showing her the path to success. Everyday heroines are often anonymous because I ask them to share their real and vulnerable stories and their real and unedited numbers. So in Katie's case, she's going to tell you her story, but I do have permission to share with you that her salary is now $160,000 a year. And you're going to hear her tell the story of how she negotiated that up from her first offer. She and her husband have $100,000 in savings together, and they have $236,000 in investment accounts. What I really love, though, is how Katie turned a philosophy that ultimately healed a cancer diagnosis into a life philosophy that, in my opinion, has served her quite well. Katie started off in a low-paying position. She was struggling with the trade-offs between a secure job with a local government that was unfulfilling for her and braving the unknown with a skill set she wasn't sure she could parlay into another role. There's that conversation about risk again. But Katie knew where she had set her sights, and she kept her chin up, and she ultimately produced incredible results in an environment that did not seem to offer her ready agreement. Kudos to Katie, and may you learn a lot from this Profit Boss today. Okay, I'm coming back to you with a little update. I spoke with Katie, and she really felt like there was some color she wanted to add around the story of her family and how she grew up that it didn't necessarily come across in the interview. And I think, so she wrote me a really nice note here, and I'm going to take some liberty with it. Essentially, Katie's family was a very traditional family. Katie's dad worked for the government for a bit, and then he started his own CPA firm, and her mom took care of the girls, the three girls, until they were older, and then she went back to work. So basically, dad was the breadwinner, and he was very much like the millionaire next door. And if you don't know what The Millionaire Next Door is, it's a famous book about how ordinary people can produce extraordinary financial results by being consistent, spending less than they make, and saving what's left and investing it. So it was a very consistent life. It was a very secure life in her experience, and her parents very much wanted that for her and to talk to her about it a lot. Dad was very consistent talking about the value, the tax value of owning a home and being a business owner and what's deferred compensation. And the trouble came when Katie didn't really see that kind of opportunity or life arise around her. She got into government employment, didn't necessarily love it, and so found herself maybe having to go a different way or choosing a different way. And so took a different route than her father most wanted her to take. She says, I still carry a little bit of guilt that I should be doing better when it comes to my savings and investments, even though I think she's doing great. But, you know, like there's definitely choices, forks in the road for her that she wonders, did I do the right thing? I did the right thing for my soul, but did I do the right thing for my finances? And that her dad has consistently been a support for her, and she really appreciates that. They also communicated to her very clearly from a young age that she needed to be prepared to take care of her own finances. Well, I got to bust in here one more time with another little addition to today's episode. My podcast production team reminded me that later in the interview, Katie says she has an awesome financial advisor, and that would be me. Katie and her husband just hired me as their financial advisor, and she's saying how much she enjoys working with me. And I want to be very, very, very clear that that is not a testimonial for my investment selection or portfolio construction services. Her little rave about working with me is only having to do with planning services, getting conversations and plans and strategies and long-term visions set, and that she's not talking about the portfolio that I build for them. They literally just started working with me, so there would be really nothing for her to rave about. The federal government and the Securities and Exchange Commission do not allow financial advisors to publish testimonials for their investment selection or portfolio construction work. So I would never do that. And I don't want you to get confused. So when she says she likes working with me, that doesn't mean that I'm picking good stocks. I, of course, don't pick stocks. As you know, I use a globally diversified portfolio of low-cost index-type mutual funds. And regardless, her comment is about, again, my planning work and not her portfolio. Even though, of course, I think my portfolios are awesome. To be clear, Katie's not talking about that. And so on to the interview. Katie, thanks for being with us on Profit Boss Radio.
Hi, Hillary. Thanks for having me.
I have been wanting to interview you for a while now. You're someone who just really impresses me with what has turned out to be not only a positive money mindset, but really good money results. And that's why I'm so excited that you're here, is because I think it's not often that everyday women get to hear from everyday women who are pulling it off, right? There's plenty of multimillionaires out there, or people who claim to be multimillionaires bragging about their Lamborghinis and mansions. And that just isn't real for very many people. So we're excited to hear how things started for you and sort of the milestones or turning points, little transformations that you feel led you to where you are today. So would you start from the beginning and just tell us a little bit about how money was handled in your household as a kid? Tell me your first experiences with money and what your parents taught you.
Absolutely. So my father is actually a CPA. So money was a conversation that we had in the house, but it was really more about my dad and money. And it was more my mom would spend it and my dad earned it. And as kids, we had an allowance and we had money, but we really didn't talk a lot about how we spend, why we spend. It was more about you have to save and you have to be prepared. And you have to actually, in our house, it was a lot of like, you also need to marry a man that's going to help support you. I'm the oldest of three girls. And so there was also a bit of a conversation about, you know, really having a partner that could really help provide for us.
Wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so how did your parents support the you have to save edict? Did they sort of force you to open savings accounts, or how did that look?
You know, the funny thing was, is there was this conversation about saving. We had a couple of things. So we had a savings account as a very young age. We would go to the bank with my mom and with my dad, and we'd put in our 75 cents and take out our candy money and things like that. But we weren't really ever saving for something serious or something large, right? It was really a bit more around like kid saving. My parents also had this interesting relationship where, you know, my dad worked, my mom spent, and they would regularly talk about, you know, my mom really got to make the spending decisions, and that there wasn't a lot of approval between the two of them. It was kind of this understood agreement. So we also learned at a young age that you don't really outwardly talk about money. You just need to have some agreements and you have to kind of figure that out.
And maybe like a little bit of, even though your parents gave lip service to a supportive relationship, that maybe some mutiny, financial mutiny in the relationship was okay. Maybe if it came from the wife, was that something that was communicated maybe?
The mutiny usually, right? My dad was really the one that, like, he was a bit more of the rule follower when it came to that, right? It was really interesting when my mom started to work and my dad retired. I had this interesting conversation with my parents, and my mom was concerned about the amount of spending my dad was doing while she was working and he was retired. And I said, well, have you talked to dad about the spending and that you're concerned about that? And she says, absolutely not. Your father never told me I couldn't spend for something, and I'm never going to do that to him now. So they didn't talk about it, but they had these interesting ways of navigating around their relationship. It wasn't something that we regularly saw my parents talking about.
Right. Got it. Okay. And so you came out of the home that you grew up in. And when was kind of your next money experience? Was it during college, or you think after college? I mean, for me, during college was like, I don't know how I made it through college. Like, I was so broke. And then I know my first salary was like $41,000 a year or something. What are your next money milestones?
So money milestone was asking parents for money so that I didn't have to move home, right? So it was really turning to my parents for help. I think, you know,
I didn't have to move home after college?
No, I didn't. I had to pay for part of it, and they would pay for part of it, right? So they had an agreement. They paid for school, I paid for housing, and I never really made enough to cover housing. So I would turn to my mom, never my dad, always my mom, to ask for money. So my next like money conversation, I remember I was just out of college, and I thought once I made $40,000 a year, I was making it big. Like, there was a very distinct number that I had, and I was finishing up graduate school. And I thought if I needed to make that certain amount of money in order to feel like I was like really making it as a person. And I remember having that conversation with my parents as well. And they had a bit of a chuckle, but I think they got it.
Okay.
I don't know where 40,000 came from, but at the time that really seemed like a pretty significant amount of money. And at the same time, I was also, you know, I was a credit card spender. I, you know, was starting to build some debt. And I didn't really talk much about my debt with my family or with friends. It was kind of a bit of a hidden secret. So in my mind, 40,000 would help cover all that.
Right. Well, of course. I mean, 40,000 is far more than any credit card bill we could have racked up. When it comes out in the form of paychecks that have taxes withheld from them, it's way less. Okay, I understand. So some of that you have to save messaging got maybe forgotten, or really not implemented, not sort of cemented in your mind in a tactical way, because it's like, okay, I get the message, but I don't have the habit.
For sure. And I would watch my mom do things like buy something but not tell my dad. Like, there were a lot of secrets around how money was spent. So I also did the same thing. Like, I would spend my money in secret and not telling anybody that I was in debt.
Right.
So
that's what I meant by mutiny.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I do remember the first time that I had to fess up to my father and explain to him how much debt I had. It was a very painful conversation, but yeah.
What did he say? Were you asking him to bail you out?
No, I was asking to move home. I was transitioning between graduate school. I was just finishing up graduate school, and I had really wanted to save some money. And I actually, you know what, now I think about it, it wasn't after graduate school. I was interested in kind of relocating somewhere. And I had to turn to him and say, in order for me to do that, I really want my debt to be gone. And he said, how much debt do you have? And I explained, and he said, wow, what do you propose? And I said, I was thinking of moving home rent free. Is that something that I could do? And he said, yes, if it's in the spirit of paying off all your debt and building your savings, absolutely. I asked for help around a payment plan. But yeah, that was hard, very hard. He's a CPA, for God's sakes, right? I mean, like, how could his daughter be in debt?
Right. So the first money shaming experience.
Yes.
Okay, I understand. And now let's fast forward a little. Was there kind of so it sounds like you went through the normal, like, well-intentioned path leads to hell kind of adolescence, young, like 20s after graduate school, like that. Mm-hmm. Was there a wake up moment or experience where your mind shifted?
I think it was when I realized that how much I was making wasn't going to support me for what I wanted to accomplish.
Do you know how'd you do that math?
You know, I was working in government. My parents were really supportive and interested in me being in a career that was safe. There was a lot of safety conversations around money and job and career. And so I was inside of government. My salary was quite low and I was dissatisfied with what I was doing and dissatisfied with where I was living. And when I started to really explore what it would take financially for me to relocate, I realized my salary couldn't support that. In addition, by that point in my incredible like early 30s, I had goals around, travel and things that I wanted. And I just realized I wasn't set up for that in my career. And that's when I had to sit down and have some, very straight and difficult conversations with my family about, okay, how can I, if I'm going to stay in this career for right now, how do I do this? And what do I need to explore?
What I'm noticing is even through it all, I mean, at some point I separated from my family and stopped talking with them about money, but you mm-hmm. have this relationship with them where you always come back there. You've talked a lot so far about open discussion, even though they were painful, about bringing it to the family. So that's interesting.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I think, given that my dad has always been my accountant, we always have to sit down every year and talk about my money, right? So there was no hiding there.
Yes, but there are other accountants in the world.
There are other accountants in the world. I think I realized at a very specific time in my life that it takes a village in order to move mountains. And for me, it was a mountain that I needed to move, and it would take my family and friends and resources and support and coaching and all of those things in order to do that. So rather than sit and be upset and frustrated and concerned, I decided it's time to take some action, and it's just going to require me to be a bit humble and expose myself.
Yeah, we talked about that a little bit in the pre-interview chat. Do you mind sharing with us that I feel like this transformational moment and experience is really critical to a lot of the success in your life? Do you mind sharing that with us?
Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah. So in my mid to late 20s, I was diagnosed with a form of cancer called Hodgkin's lymphoma. And at the time, I was finishing my graduate school and was in an internship at Stanford. And the diagnosis was stage 4, and it was quite advanced, and it was going to require chemotherapy. And at that time, I had, a lot of really exciting things happening for me in my life and in my career. I was really clear about where I wanted to go and what I wanted to do, and was young. And I decided, I had mentioned earlier that I had a conversation with a couple of family members and friends. And I remember this distinct moment of actually saying out loud, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to have a damn good time. Like, we're really going to do this big. And I'm not sure where that came from, but I was clear that how my next year was going to be incredibly challenging, given what I was needing to do medically as well as personally, and I couldn't do it by myself. So, in the space of really deciding that I was going to go big rather than go home, it really opened up a whole host of resources that I didn't even think about. And people came to me, and I had, coaches and support and structures and friends. And it was an extraordinary experience. It was a village, and, my parents needed support. My sisters needed support, and I needed support. And it was just this incredibly humbling experience of, I can't do this by myself if I really want to do this the way that I want to do it. So I think that really started for me the space to just really ask for help, ask questions, and rally my village is really what I did. It was a really rally cry for my village.
It's a really amazing story and really very compelling. And thank you for sharing it in a vulnerable way. And you and I have, shared with me before about your cancer diagnosis, and obviously that had a successful outcome, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, good.
It did. Yes. No, I'm healthy and fantastic. Thank you.
You are fantastic. Yes, you are. I just wanted to wrap that up for people who are close to tears. Like, she had cancer, now she doesn't. And so you were saying that you really got to thinking that this became a framework a framework for thinking mm-hmm. about big problems in life. And so did money become one of those problems that you applied this It Takes a Village framework to?
Absolutely. Around that time is when I also had to have the very honest conversation with my family about my financial goals and my career. But at the same time, I also had recognized that I had a bit of there was a head game for me around how I was relating to my money. I was still in a career that didn't have significant earning potential. I felt stuck. I really wanted to increase not only my earnings, but my experience of feeling successful around my money. And I didn't have that. And I felt a bit stuck. And a bit trapped, I wasn't really quite sure where to go. And I didn't feel comfortable having those types of conversations with my dad. He was much more transactional versus kind of the head game around money. So I seeked out a financial coach, somebody that was specifically going to be working with me on my head game around my money. We really didn't talk about how to increase my earning potential or what I needed to be doing on a savings perspective. We actually really talked about, my family history and the family conversations we had around money, like how I related to myself, how I related to my earning potential, what I thought was where there were caps for myself around that. And it was a very powerful time to actually be able to do that. It was incredibly interesting as well. And we had tears and we had laughs, all of it. She was a bit of my money therapist is what I called her, actually.
So I think maybe this is around the time that you and I actually met. And what impressed me about you at that time, first of all, there was no outward appearance that money limited you. You didn't say things like, I can't afford that, or, you didn't have a luxurious necessarily life, but here we are in the San Francisco Bay Area and life is expensive. And you just always had a really empowered mindset. So I think you're describing that as in the world, I'm limited. I work for government. My salary is low. My experience of being successful isn't what I want. And yet I'm constantly in the headspace of what's next, how is it going to expand for me?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
So what actions did that mindset lead you to take?
It actually had me take a couple of steps. I first seeked out a coach specifically around career, and I seeked out a coach that worked in government at the time, but had an extraordinary experience in the private sector. And that was very successful in what he was doing. And I started there. I started talking with somebody that could help me create a safe space to start talking about seeking roles that were either outside of government or inside of government that were very distinct from what I was doing.
And when you say a coach, were you paying these people?
So the first person that I reached out to was a mentor. I reached out to him. I started to talk with a few colleagues. I was for the city that I was working for, and he was recommended as a resource. And so I asked them to do an introduction for me, and he had the graciousness of his own time, coached me for about 4 months. And, as a result, I actually was considering going back to school for my MBA. I started to actually take the exam to be able to go in to actually apply to MBA schools. I was offered an opportunity to join another city and, report to a city manager and to really consider and look at, becoming that executive CEO of a city. And I had an extraordinary amount of opportunities presented in front of me just by sitting down and asking for some time.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like we could do a whole episode on asking for mentors. And I did the same thing at one time. I asked one of the most successful female financial advisors I know to mentor me, and she accepted. And it's always been something I've been eternally grateful for. Okay. So you're taking steps, you're getting coaching, having opportunities presented to you. And what happens next?
So was in a specific area inside of government, and I got offered a role that would track me to become the CEO of a city, essentially. Uh-huh. And I had an increase in my earnings. I moved into another organization. My opportunities really kind of started to present themselves even more inside of government. And, you know, I could see a potential trajectory for myself with starting to either want both have higher earning potential, but to have a greater sense of satisfaction, right? So I made that transition, and it was a very exciting transition for me. It was something that I really appreciated and loved. And while I was in that space, I then saw this was not the place for me. And I had invested at this point about 14 years of my career into government. And so I got to the point where I realized that government wasn't the place for me. And I think I had to kind of really explore all of my options before I got to that decision. And thankfully, you know, I would continue to have coaches, right? So I was bold enough to ask, a very highly popular, well-known city manager and asked her to be my coach. I regularly and continued to, get coaching. And at this point, they were still not paid. I'm asking for mentorship. I'm asking for sounding boards. And I'm asking that from people at different roles inside of government, but it definitely at high levels.
So take me under your wing. Let me come sit in your office, ask you questions, cry when I need to.
Exactly.
And like, men and women.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. Okay. I think strategically women in the city manager roles, as well as strategically men, right? Really wanting to get a balanced perspective. And at the time it really was like, can you help me with this one problem I'm having? Right. I mean, it was even is very tactical to even, I'm not sure if government's the spot for me. Like where do you see, government leadership heading? And knowing my personality, my style, getting some insight from them, where do you see me? Like, I'm having a hard time seeing me here. Am I missing something? Do you see me here? Like, where do you think I could really make a difference? So again, I was just very open because I was struggling myself and I just wasn't sure if there was something I was missing. So I was really always oftentimes asking for an insider perspective.
I feel like you could write a book on this. I mean, so few people, I think, do this. So take us to that moment when you, or was it a decision process? Was there a moment when you said, I give up 14 years of my career? This is not the direction for me. I've got to find something else. Or was it slow?
You know, that's a great question. I'm thinking about this. I think it was slow in the sense that I needed to really get my feet into different perspectives before I made a decision that wasn't for me. And then when I realized it wasn't for me, that was fast. Like that became super clear. But I did take a lot of time to really explore, right? And I had two things that had happened that I think really pushed me to kind of take a leap. I was working in an organization where it was clear I needed to leave. Like it just wasn't the right size and the right environment. And I wasn't the right match for the city as well. And I needed to look for my next, like that was very clear for me. And at the same time, my boyfriend, who's my husband now, was also exploring, looking at opportunities beyond the Bay Area. And I realized that my experience and my history, my work history really locked me into only very specific areas and very specific things. And it was quite limited, right? Government was also still trying to recover from the recession. And while the private sector recovers quickly, the public sector goes much slower and behind, right? So their cities were still laying off, downsizing, streamlining, really important approaches and strategies, but it just really reduced the number of available roles. So I just really realized I was locked in and I felt stuck. And I've regularly noticed if I feel this sense of stuckness, it really is a huge push for me to move. So I realized it was time. It was desperately time.
So how are your financials at this point, at this juncture?
You know, at this juncture, they are, I'm living paycheck to paycheck. I have roommates to afford living where I'm living. I have time to take vacations. I'm in government, so I have a lot of time for that. But it's a bit limited on what I can do, and I'm relying heavily on credit card debt, right? I'm like relying on credit card and things like that. And I'm also feeling like there's not a lot of earning, like I'm not really seeing like how I could, seeing a lot of friends living in the Bay Area, and especially living where I'm at, seeing a lot of friends that are having these ongoing regular increases in their earnings and feeling a bit of frustration, disappointment.
So given you didn't have a lot of evidence for, I'm clear how this money thing is going to work out. I mean, you were a government employee, so there were benefits, right? Was there financial benefits?
Yeah, there were benefits. I had a retirement that I was contributing to, so essentially a pension. I also had a 405, a 401. Oh my goodness, I can't remember what the terminology is. 403B. Where I can make additional contributions. I did it really
deferred comp.
Deferred comp.
Yeah.
What is
it? I don't know the numbers. I just call it deferred comp. It's not 401. But I think you had a 403B and a deferred comp plan.
Correct. And at the time, I was making, my income was also public. So I was making at that time $110,000 a year.
And they published that in the newspaper, right?
Yes. Yes. And prior to that,
For those of you who have long drawn out debates about whether or not salaries should be publicized, Katie's was.
Right. You can do a search for my salary at any point in my time in my career. And unfortunately, it oftentimes was published in the newspaper as well. So not only could you go and look on it for it online, you would regularly see in the newspaper everybody's salary. So it created, you know, salary then became just not something you would ever have to wonder. You just knew exactly where everybody was at. So right prior to my salary at 110, I was making 80, and I was at 80 for about 10 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Gosh, that's like the opposite of motivational.
Right.
Yeah.
And there was no, the next role for me that I would potentially be even eligible for, at least in the department that I was in, because it was very step by step. You couldn't hop, jump around, right? You couldn't jump past a specific stage. I think I would start at maybe 88. Right.
Right. And to those of you listening who are saying, hold on a second, I dream about making $80,000 a year. I just have to understand, first of all, when I say it's the opposite of motivational, I just mean that for someone with big aspirations, being at the same salary for many, many years, it's just like, I want to grow. I'm not growing. And so you begin to get deflated. And also life is just really, 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 really expensive here. So kind of the numbers are bigger.
Yes.
Okay. So here you are at this juncture. You're not happy professionally, but life does you the favor of expelling you from this organization you thought was it for you. You thought, I'm going to land here. I'm going to be here. I'm going to be the CEO of the city. And then it's like, nope, not happening.
Yeah.
So what comes next?
A fear. And a little bit of panic.
All that safety your parents used to talk about down the drain.
Absolutely. My father in particular was super concerned, right, that I would be leaving something that would has a pension and has some, I'm doing air quotes right now, of, you know, security.
Thank you. Because everything on podcast has to be in audio.
And I learned that, you know, in government, there isn't security either. So I didn't even know what was out there that I was even interested in. I had no idea. So I reached out to my friends and my network, and I said, I'm changing careers. I'm transitioning out of government, and I'm trying to look into what's next for myself. I'd love to spend some time with you and hearing more about what you do for work. And I think I had like 20 different informational interviews with friends, from things on, you know, business development and the world of business development to software, human resources, sales, marketing. I have a pretty outgoing personality, so I kind of knew already there would be some general areas that were going to be not of interest and some areas that I didn't even know existed. And so I just reached out to my village. And I started there. I started there and used that as a place to at least to explore and to learn, because I recognized that there's not only a world, there's a language, there's a whole language and terminology of things that I wasn't aware of.
And what did you learn that became of use to you?
So I learned that I had an incredible network of people. I think that was the first thing that I learned, that my friends and my colleagues were incredibly generous with their time. So I learned very quickly that I had a really strong network of resources. I learned that it was going to be potentially challenging moving from government into the private sector. Moving from government into the private sector, that there was already some preconceived notions about government employees. And so I learned very quickly that there was a bit of a hurdle that I would need to jump through around that. I also learned that the work that I was doing was incredibly transferable and that there was a bit of a needing to find a role or a company that was willing to take a risk with me, because I just didn't have the portfolio experience that would make them think, oh, yes, of course, this is Katie's next role, because I was doing such an about face from government. And I was also, I didn't want to work inside of a large system, like a large company.
A small organization was probably a better fit.
It was going to be a better fit, right? So, because I learned that people in that environment were definitely much more willing to take a risk on somebody that, you know, didn't have all of the pedigree or the background that was, you know, directly correlated. And that I think inside of larger organizations are a bit more rooted around like institutional experience. So I needed a risky company, a risky group.
Okay. What was that group or what came next?
Yeah. So I transitioned into a role where I was a consultant for a communications and PR agency. And one of their large clients was government agencies, specifically in the Bay Area. So they were really looking for somebody that could do a bit more organizational development and coaching and support for larger government agencies. So somebody that had that experience and knowledge, but also was a bit of a risk taker and had a bit more of a engaging style than you kind of typically would experience inside a government.
So kind of a hybrid role.
Yeah. And I knew at the time, I knew that I was going to need to find an interim spot. That was one of the other things that I learned, is I'm going to need an interim, a place where I could generate a bit of street cred. One, find out if it was really a right match for me. Like I had some assumptions that government wasn't the spot, and I just really needed to test the waters. And so I needed an in-between spot.
Okay, got it. All right, great. And so you've increased your salary. So I imagine you were able to start saving more or start saving again at that point into like a retirement account. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. It was great. So in addition to being able to save, I was also able to do things like, you know, take care of some credit card debt and things like that. It was a wonderful time.
Yeah. I have an extra $1,000 a month.
Like, this is great.
Yeah, I bet. Okay, yeah. Good. And I know there have been a few career changes since then, but so I kind of want to get more macro at this point. Mm-hmm. You did a pretty amazing thing in your last career change, which is you negotiated for the salary that you wanted. Would you share a little bit about that and how that came about?
Yes. So I was starting into a new role and I had a very specific salary amount that I was actually very interested in. Mm-hmm. And at the time, in order to make this career shift, I had actually hired a career coach who was working with me on a variety of things, including my, you know, social media presence, my resume, really even helping me fine tune some of the types of roles that I was really looking at that would be a good match for my skill set and for my long-term career goals. And so during that process, I was offered 3 different jobs at that time. And this was like my first opportunity of really getting to have to negotiate salaries at the level that I wanted. And so I had a conversation with my coach and I said, this is the salary that I want. And it was $150. And she said, well, then that's the salary you should ask. And we had this conversation about my perception of my wealth potential or my value. And so I really had to wrestle with my own head about how much I thought I should be earning and what I wanted to earn. And they were very different. And so I was very scared to actually ask for that amount. And when I did, they came back and said yes. And the interesting thing is I responded and I said, great, thank you. Actually, I'd like an additional 15 more. And it was...
What did it take to have that conversation?
It took a handful of calls with a... a friend of mine who was also providing me coaching.
A very confident coach.
Yes. So, I had two coaches. I had a coach that I was paying for, and then I had a friend who was incredibly successful around salary negotiations for himself. And I called and said, what do I do? They said, yes. He said, well, you need to tell them you need more. And I said, how do I do that? And he said, well, here's what you say. And I said, great.
And is that literally what you said? I'd like 15 more?
I said, thank you. Thank you. The funny thing is they actually responded first with an offer that was higher than what I had requested. And I realized I undersold myself from the get-go, right?
Yeah.
And I thought, well, hell, how am I going to reconcile this? And hence why I talked to my friend. And he said, well, at the time I also had two other opportunities that were in front of me. And he said, based on where I'm at in demand right now, I said, my salary really warrants this amount and I choose Showpad if you're able to make that transition.
Good on you. Good on you. So you literally said, I will say yes today, which is what the recruiter wants if you make the number this. And what you're kind of betting is that they already have the negotiation flexibility to say yes to that number. And it sounds like your person did. Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Okay. And what are some of the other, at this point, you are on a good path financially. What are some of the other, are there any other things that you feel that you've done that contribute to the expansiveness of your financial life? Do you want to share with us any specifics or numbers or how you and your husband talk about saving? I'm specifically look at you as someone who always has had an empowered mindset despite outward results that might not reflect that. In other words, if you were going to take your results at the time and extrapolate to the future, your mindset wouldn't have been what it was. And so I'm specifically interested in sharing with my audience how you did that, what specific actions you took, and the impact you feel it had.
So there's since that time, I've gotten married, right? So my husband and I have very different perspectives when it comes to money. And I noticed my parents' dynamic and I could see what I was doing was a bit of what my mom did. And so I...
Kudos to you, by the way.
Well, thank you. Thanks. I have a really great financial advisor. And at the time, Hillary, you were offering a program for couples, right? To really explore their money conversation as a couple. And I could see for Lauren and I, we were going to be heading in the direction of marriage, that this would be a really important topic for us to talk about, just given that we had very, very different approaches to money. He's a saver, I'm a spender. We're very across the board, very different. And so we first started there. It was incredibly helpful because it made the conversation about money a bit more public, or a lot more public. We shared with each other our finances. I shared where I was with credit card debt. I shared where I was with savings. It required him to think through and pull those numbers together as well. So that was the beginning of us having a more of a public conversation about our money. And given that we had such different styles around money, he had concerns about my spending and my savings. So, it also had us talk about savings goals and spending goals and retirement goals and, the reality of what that number needs to be. And it also then influenced other conversations like his earning potential, my earning potential, where do we want to be living in order to meet our financial goals? It just really was a starting point for a lot of other conversations. So since that time, we also have gotten ourselves a financial advisor that regularly meets with us and coaches us on a regular basis around our money. And we have specific goals around that. We're selling some property that my husband had in another country. We're taking some very specific actions around our money and getting us more prepared for our future. But all of that, I think, is a result of you know, having very public conversations with other people about our money.
Wow. So do you just walk into dinner parties and have public conversations about your money, or is it more confined?
Oh, thanks for clarifying that. I think there's two ways it is a public conversation about our money. One, we talk to our financial advisor, like our wealth advisor, together. Like that's public.
Okay, got it.
You know, we sit down and have conversations with you. And in preparation for that, him and I have conversations about our money. And because it's open, you know, there's no secrets around it. It provides a lot more space for us to talk. We still have arguments and conversations and disagreements and fights around money. I mean, that's never going to stop. But I think the big difference that it's made for myself, and I would say for my husband, is that we like reliably have a safe place to talk about it, and that we're talking with somebody that we have confidence in, knowing that we don't know everything that there is to know about what we're up to, like how to get there. So we're both very honest in saying that we're not quite sure how to get there, but we're going to take the coaching.
So I guess I sort of want to, and now I'm totally leading the witness, so it's good that I'm a CFP and not a lawyer, because they would like gavel me or something. But I sort of want you to encapsulate your mindset. Like if you were teaching a young woman and you were going to say, look, I look back over my life and it's not always obvious that I would end up with a relatively high dual income on a good path financially, but my mindset was always X. Like, would you say I always knew I was destined for better things, or no matter what, I was going to get there? Or is there a way that you think about that?
I don't know. I don't think I always knew. I never really always knew where I was heading. Like, I still, at the ripe age of 43, am clear there's another career for myself, and I'm not quite sure what it is. So I guess my mindset is I've always been open and wanting to explore. And I think my mindset is I'm really curious and wanting to learn. So I'm always putting myself in situations for that. And because of that, I've had these opportunities along the way. I do think, though, financially, I had a vision of myself having a good amount of wealth, right?
Exactly. I think
I always had that vision.
And you're
myself.
Always living into that vision, right? Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
I think that really is it, because it guides your choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, thanks for asking that, because as you're asking and talking, I'm just trying to picture myself, and I never pictured myself being comfortable with kind of base level wealth. I was really considered myself wanting to be in the world of I wouldn't say the word opulent, but yeah, high wealth.
Opulence. Yeah, of course. I mean, I talk a lot about intermittent opulence. Like, I have opulence at least one day a month.
Right. I did buy this purse, and it was really lovely. It's like lovely opulent purse. I have an opulent purse.
I had a diatribe on an episode. I just recorded the introduction for, and I talked about $800 shoes and $1,000 purses. And I went off. But I did say, oh, sometimes I spend $400 on a bag. I do. Intermittent opulence.
Right. I do remember there was a time in my life where I thought if I had a bottle of white wine, a bottle of champagne, and a red wine on the counter, I'd made it. Like, if I was somebody that would regularly have those things in the refrigerator, right? Yeah.
That's opulence.
Right. I thought, well, look at me, I'm fancy. I mean, it was really about that.
You always have been fancy.
I try.
Hey, listen, I can't thank you enough. I've had this interview in my mind's eye for literally years, probably even before I launched the podcast. So it's the fruition of a small but important dream. And you're amazing. And I'm proud to feature you on the show as an everyday heroine. So thanks for what you did for yourself to empower yourself and what you've now done to empower other women.
Thank you, Hillary. Thanks for the chance to talk with you today.
Profit Boss, thanks for making it to the end of another episode of PBR. I have been doing a lot of thinking about you. I'm thinking about how hard it can be to change old habits. I mean, sometimes I think how nice it would be if things worked like they did for Keanu Reeves in those Matrix movies. If we could just lie back in an industrial punk rock barber chair and have a little cable plugged into the backs of our necks and just instantly become the masters of our financial domains. That would be kind of perfect, right? Except for the part about having the cable plugged into the back of your neck and the whole industrial punk thing. And Keanu Reeves is so annoying when you get right down to it. But I think it's important to form new habits, especially ones as fun as being alerted when new episodes of Profit Boss Radio go live. You want to know a secret? This is one habit that's almost no work at all. All you have to do is head over to iTunes, find the Profit Boss Radio channel, and hit subscribe. That's it. Then each week, you'll automatically find the latest episode ready and waiting on your favorite device. And the best part is that subscribing to Profit Boss Radio is just the beginning of other wonderful habits, like taking control of your money and learning how to build wealth or starring in your own reality show. Well, maybe not that one, unless it's on YouTube and self-produced. But plenty of great stuff is sure to happen when you subscribe. So what are you waiting for?
Thank you for listening to Profit Boss Radio, where creating success on our own terms happens every day. You're not alone in your journey to a rich life, and that's why Hillary is here to add value in each and every episode. See you next time on the podcast for women and money.